From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When it comes to the U.S. economy and the politics around it, New York Times columnist and economist Paul Krugman calls it like he sees it, and right now he doesn't like what he sees. He has big questions about the business history and inclinations of President Bush and Vice President Cheney, and big questions about how the president's posse of economic advisors has been responding to the economic crisis. A real economist in the realm of talking heads, Krugman has flayed the Bush administration for what he sees as secrets, lies, and bad economic policies. The current crisis in American capitalism, he wrote, isn't just about tricky accounting. It's about how the game has been rigged by insiders, and nobody's more on the inside than President Bush. Tonight, Paul Krugman is off the page and on the air. Does the Bush administration deserve a gadfly with a bite this big? Is George W. Bush the poser that Paul Krugman claims? And what do you make of the Bush economic recovery policy? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Princeton, New Jersey is Paul Krugman. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Krugman.
Hi there.
Hi, thanks for being with us again.
Sure.
Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Paul Krugman.
Hi there.
Paul Krugman, you have written that only today that our economic problems, which everybody is focused on like crazy with the market doing what it's doing, that our economic problems are real but by no means catastrophic. So why are you so upset?
Well, it's not very hard to at least think of a set of sensible steps. We have a market that's got us all really upset. We've got an economy which has got a kind of a sputtering recovery, and the market's not going to help that. We also have a return to budget deficits. None of that is really very hard to deal with, but there's no indication whatsoever that the Bush team is prepared to reconsider policies that were really conceived 3 years ago in a very different time.
The president seems to suggest that reconsideration isn't really necessary. He's said repeatedly, and again just today or yesterday, that the economy is fundamentally sound. Let's start with the point of pain, which right now is the stock market most immediately. When you look at the president's statements in recent days and you look at the market, what's the connective tissue here?
Well, the first thing is that he's violated the cardinal rule, which is that the president, or in fact anyone in the administration, never talks about where you think stock prices should be, if only because the truth is nobody knows where stock prices should be, and that's you've got at least a 50% chance of looking like an utter fool and blowing credibility unnecessarily. There's a kind of a funny tone in his the way he talks, which is sort of querulous. Why are the markets doing this to me? They're not reasonable. I guess I would say, again, that's not the way you're supposed to talk. And to put my edge on here, to say that he's got something that his friends can't fix.
That his friends can't fix. And this brings up your consistent theme, Paul Krugman, that George Bush came by his wealth in a dubious fashion, and that, as you said in what we quoted earlier in the introduction, it's an insider's game of American business today, and it's rigged for insiders. Can that case fairly be made for George Bush?
Well, it's unmistakable. It's certainly, he hasn't come to wealth the way most people who get wealthy got there. There are no business successes. There are no successful investments. He consistently failed upwards. The only thing that went right was a quasi-public venture, which is the Texas Rangers, and that's a story that gets worse the more you look at it. It's not clear, let's be clear, it's not clear there's anything illegal in there, but it's not at all it bears no resemblance to the official portrait. And that, I think, is what's crucial here. No administration that I can remember has laid as much stress on the character issue. The answer to everything that you ask about the Bush administration, those budget numbers don't add up. They say, no, but we have a man of character leading the country. What really went on in that energy task force? Don't worry your little pretty heads. We've got a man of character running the country. And yet the portrait of Mr. Bush, a self-made businessman, someone who really loves his ranch more than he loves the corridors of power, bears no resemblance to reality. Even the ranch turns out to be a sham, but that's another story.
We're going to come back and look at how that may figure into what's going on in economic policy and pronouncements out of Washington right now, a little later. But Paul Krugman, give us your prescription, if you've got one. What should the Bush administration be doing that it's not to get the economy revved up again and perhaps, as a consequence, do something for the market?
This is almost a textbook story. I mean, what do we have? We have a weak economy. That means that you want the government to be keeping things loose now. You certainly don't want to raise taxes now. You certainly don't want to slash spending now, because we need purchasing power in this economy. On the other hand, we've had a drastic deterioration of the long-run budget outlook. So what do you need to do? You need to do a twist. You need to relax the reins at least a little bit now. And the most pressing point right now is some aid to state and local governments, which are in desperate straits. But you need to reassure the financial markets and all of us that the U.S. government is going to remain solvent in the next decade, which means that those future tax cuts, which is, 60% of the Bush tax cut hasn't yet happened, really have to be canceled, or at the very least put on ice until there's some better budget news. So it's just a question, give up the future tax cuts, do something to put more money into the economy now. It's an Econ 101 solution, actually, and it's also absolutely inconceivable from these guys.
Because this was bedrock campaign policy and after for the Bush administration. Is there any chance in perdition, to use a current word, that George Bush is going to voluntarily step back from those tax cuts?
Well, I can, if we have Dow 5,000 and the unemployment rate has gone to 7 or 8%, which is, alas, not completely out of the question, then we can imagine that a lot of things that are now completely impossible will start to become possible. Maybe the IMF will come in and dictate a change in policy, there are some family resemblances between what's happening to us now and what happened to some of those Asian economies. I don't want to be alarmist here, but just to say there are some similarities. But at the moment, the striking thing about economic policy in this administration is that there isn't any economic policy, or there's one economic policy which has been the same ever since. Whatever the problem is, I once wrote a column called "The Magic Elixir," the universal elixir. The tax cut is the answer to all problems, and it's going to take a major mind shift, complete change in operating procedure for any of that to move.
Jack Beatty, it can't be much fun for the economic team in the Bush administration to have a columnist and an economist like Paul Krugman rattling their chain with such confidence and so very often.
Yeah, and so relentlessly. And I think we just heard an example of Paul's excellence. No ideology, just straight economic analysis, as he says, textbook stuff, and just laying that rational, analysis as against this ideologically driven policy. I mean, that's an example of what he does every day. He's rarely, if ever, corrected on a fact. And he has flayed Lawrence Lindsay, the president's chief economic advisor, as basically a kind of dishonest scholar. Paul, would you say more about that?
Well, let me say, there are good people. There are good people in the Bush economic team. There are certainly some smart people, and Lindsay is no fool. But they don't seem to have any role on big decisions. And it's intriguing, actually, that Lindsay, as I say, he's no fool, but he's not, he's not an economist at all. There are people who are economists. John Taylor at Treasury is someone who everyone I know thinks of quite highly, who is a conservative professional economist. Lindsay is a professional conservative economist. It's not the same thing, and Lindsay's the one who gets to call the shots. And that's I think the problem. I would be writing very differently if this was simply an honest conservative administration where they simply they didn't cook the books. They actually proposed things that I didn't think would work, but where there was a theory which did say they would work. That's not the way it's been. This is a relentlessly, we know what we want, and we'll say whatever we need to say to get it, administration. And that's forced me to be a much more polemical columnist than I had.
Well, I wonder, Paul Krugman, Jack Beatty gives you the accolade of economist without ideology, but you have been sharply criticized as being partisan for the relentlessness and maybe the acuteness of your attacks on the administration on the op-ed page. What do you say to that?
Well, what am I supposed to do? I guess is the question. Now, you know, when I signed on to write for the New York Times, my ideology, such as it is, I think is very moderate liberal. I'm not a notable leftist by any measure.
But not a compassionate conservative either.
No, I mean it's clear that you know I basically believe that we need a certain amount of income redistribution to have a decent society. Not socialism, but a little bit of, you know, I believe in a fairly high social safety net. So that's where you can place me. But I also believe that markets are very good things, and we should rely on them a lot. I signed on to write for the Times at a time when we thought that it would be mostly business stories. I'd be writing about the changing structure of markets. I'd be writing about mergers and all that. And then along came this government, which is not just to the right of me. That would be one thing, but which is, again, dishonest in a way that I never anticipated facing. Some of my friends say, can't we have more, you know, economic analysis on other things? But, you know, I've got this, the Times has given me a lease on this piece of journalistic real estate, which is the most precious journalistic real estate in the world. And I've got to use it for the things that I think are most important.
Take us in then to that heart of darkness that you think you've discovered there. What's the kind of core dishonesty or the basic elements of dishonesty that you see in the Bush economic policy and maybe analysis?
Oh, gosh. I mean, what's amazing about it is that it's on so many fronts. If I had to say the thing that really started me going was the Social Security plan, which is probably not going anywhere, but I think is indicative. It's entirely based upon the assertion that 2 - 1 = 4.
This is the privatization of part of the Social Security program.
It's entirely based on the notion that you can take, you know, with the Social Security, as we know, is a system in which the younger generation pays taxes, which provide benefits to the older generation, and then the next generation will do the same for them. You can argue about whether that's a good system, but if you plan to change it, you've got to make up for the resources. You've got to find somebody else to pay the benefits to retirees as they reach retirement age. The entire Bush plan is based on the notion that you can let younger workers take their Social Security contributions, invest it in personal accounts, and they'll get a great return, and then you wait for the next step, and who will pay the benefits to the retirees? And there's no answer.
Is this so different, Paul Krugman, from levels of playing fast and loose with Social Security reality that we've seen from many administrations? I mean, is the level of dishonesty, doesn't every presidency have some kinds of dissembling that go on to get people to come along with their view of the world? Is it so different?
Not on this scale. In fact, you know, whatever Bill Clinton may have done with his sex life, the economic analysis was actually remarkably scrupulous. I never found anything in the economic reports of the Clinton years, and I was not friends, by the way, with the Clinton people. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the early years, they didn't like me, and I didn't like them. But they were always careful to make sure that things added up. And I think this is really on a completely different scale.
So what's driving it, in your view?
At some level, I don't understand. Let me admit, there's something sociological, something political. I don't quite understand why there's such a driven, angry determination to tear up our whole system of institutions by people who, you know, who certainly themselves live very well, and at a time when the U.S. was, you know, until about 2 years ago, doing extremely well. A lot of it is simply that they've discovered. I mean, Karl Rove is an evil genius. He's discovered something important about America, which is that you can tell really big lies and really won't get called on them.
There you go, Paul Krugman.
I'm not pulling punches here.
With the big lie theory attached to Karl Rove and through him straight to the Bush White House. We're talking tonight with New York Times columnist and economist Paul Krugman about fact and fiction and the Bush administration. You can deliver your own big question to Paul Krugman. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think? Does the Bush administration deserve a gadfly with this big a bite? Is he a gadfly or just a well-informed truth teller? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. 423-TALK to talk with Paul Krugman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New York Times columnist and Princeton economist Paul Krugman about fact and fiction and the Bush administration and maybe this whole big economic swirl that we're in at the moment. What do you think of President Bush's economic leadership, of the president's economic team? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Scott's on the line. Welcome, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to point out a couple of things. I hate to interrupt this nice little self-licking ice cream cone that you all have here.
Bring it on, Scott. Bring it on.
You're in a nice little agreement fest. I'm interested because Mr. Krugman seems to have already contradicted himself. One of the first things he said is that you don't want to raise taxes in a situation like this, and in almost the same breath he goes on and says, but, you know, we want to increase spending and eliminate these tax cuts. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the tax cuts have already been enacted. Therefore, if you eliminate tax cuts, you're raising taxes. I mean, perhaps I'm just a layperson, and that seems pointedly obvious to me. But
Scott, hold that thought right there. Let's mix it up. Paul Krugman, your response.
Okay. Let me tell you about the Bush tax cut. It had basically two parts. The first part is the one you've gotten already. It's the rebate. It's the tax cut that affects ordinary families. It's $300 or $600, depending. No one, me included, is suggesting undoing that. The second part is the stuff that was, as they say in the jargon, backloaded. It's the stuff that didn't happen yet because they didn't want you to see the full cost on revenue. It's the big tax cuts for people who are in the 39% bracket. And the elimination of the inheritance tax, no matter how big your estate is.
But Paul Krugman, that doesn't really go to Scott's point, does it? I mean, if you do away with those cuts,
those haven't happened yet. Remember, those haven't happened yet.
But they're baked in the cake now.
They're baked in the cake. But we're talking about canceling tax cuts, many of which don't take place until the year 2010, but which are weighing on the minds of anyone who's looking at the long run budget position of the United States. So as to say, look, it's not clear we can afford these things in the long run, but we're talking about trying to ensure that money continues flowing into people's pockets this year. So it's all that, this, by the way, is part of the deliberate confusion that's been spread here.
You try to use the
short-run situation, what's happening in the economy right now, to say we have to have tax cuts. Then you use that to justify tax cuts that don't happen for 5 years or even 10 years. And then if somebody says, wait a second, can we afford that? And they say, well, do you want a recession?
Well, Scott, have at it.
If I can respond to that,
please.
Little bit of deliberate confusion right there. Are you saying that the thing that's causing economic crisis now is concerns that the United States government is going to go bankrupt? I think that the thing that is causing problems right now in the economy is concerns about corporate earnings and individual incomes.
I think, again, you're taking something I didn't say. Problems in the U.S. economy.
Hang on, Scott. Let's get the response.
Sure.
The U.S. economy is having problems because of at least three things. But there's problems with overinvestment and never mind. The point, we have an economic crisis which has very little to do. At no point did I say that the Bushies are responsible for the slowdown in the economy. The point is that the things that you would normally do at this point, which include in particular trying to do something to alleviate the impact, a big drag on the economy right now is the fact that state and local governments are in deep yogurt, as Bush's father used to say.
Mm.
The federal government ought to be doing something to help them avoid the cutbacks that will greatly worsen the recession. The reason why we can't even consider doing that right now is that everybody takes a look and says, these are not just going to be temporary things because it's all right to be in a deficit for 1 year or 2 years, but we're now looking at deficits as far as the eye can see. And the reason we're seeing those deficits as far as the eye can see is the fact that there are lots of tax cuts that are already baked in the cake but haven't happened yet. If we take that out of the picture, then we're in a position to be a lot more open-handed right now.
Scott, give us your reply and your second issue.
Well, Well, I guess my reply to that is that you're far better economist than most people could ever lay claim to, because the implication there is that, this money that the federal government that will be giving to the states is going to be magicked out of nowhere. I'm sorry, you're taking it out of individual people's pockets, and you're talking about a situation where people, individuals, are hurting, and you're suggesting that the way to help this whole situation is to take money from individuals and redistribute it.
Paul, we're not going to solve that one, Scott. Take us on to your second point.
I'm sorry, that actually was my first. That was my only point, that what you're proposing here seems to be raising taxes as opposed to coming up with an actual solution. My overall point here is that what you should be doing when you're facing an economic crisis is taking a kind of economic Hippocratic oath. You want to do no harm. And the proposal that the way to help the economy right now is to eliminate, you know, future tax cuts that simply haven't taken effect yet, although they have been enacted, seems to me precisely the opposite of the kind of thing that you want to do. If you want to rev up the economy, then perhaps what we should be talking about is further tax cuts. And, you know,
Scott, we've got your view. I want to put it over to Paul Krugman. And thanks for your call. Paul.
The question, I mean, all of this is, you know, the tax cuts always sound good if you don't ask, well, how does the federal government in the end balance its books? Because in the end, not in any given year, but in the end it must. And we have a large, you know, in the future we have large demands on the federal government. We have my generation, I'm pushing 50 here, is going to start retiring in large numbers. The federal budget is dominated by Social Security and Medicare. Those are a lot bigger than defense, and much bigger than anything else. Those things are going to be a huge demand on the federal budget. What we should be doing is paying down the debt, getting ready. Instead, we're running up debt. We're now in a situation where we have $160 billion deficit this fiscal year, although the administration says it's going to go down next year. Not a single private analyst I know believes that. This is not a situation where you can say, well, let's have more tax cuts without any compensation, because then you have the question, how are we going to pay the bills come, you know, the year 2010, the year 2011?
And to Scott's point that goes to kind of fundamental ideology here, he says it doesn't matter when the tax cuts are. They're tax cuts, and I guess in his lexicon that's good. If you take them away, it's a tax hike, and that's going to hurt the economy.
Well, that's word games.
Why so? In the past, is it really word games to say lower taxes may be a boost to the economy?
Well, let's think about what we're talking about here. Most of the things that are on the table in this kind of discussion, of course, nothing is really on the table, but the things that we're talking about is let's not eliminate the estate tax in 2010. Let's not cut the top marginal rate, which applies to generally speaking, people with only $250,000 or more per year. Let's not cut that in the year 2010. So what you're saying is, well, it'll depress the economy because people who stand to inherit $10 million will say, gee, I won't get the full amount if my mother dies in 2010. So I guess I better not go out and buy that Jaguar now. Or people who are making $400,000 a year or $600,000 a year on Wall Street will say, gee, I was counting on having lower taxes in the year 2010. Now that's not going to happen, so I'm not going to go out and order that big dinner. I'm not saying things like that never happen, but this doesn't sound like a major consideration in policy, and it sounds a lot less relevant than the fact that the governor of New Jersey and the governor of California and the governor of Texas are all busy slashing Medicaid payments to the elderly poor because they don't have enough money.
And yet, Jack Beatty, you can hear in our caller Scott's comments the perspective that is still behind George W. Bush here, and that view saying, look, let's not mess around. Just cut taxes. Not as simple as that, but cut taxes, and that sooner or later is the path to growth.
Yeah, you know, what strikes me about this is how ahistorical it is. That is, we just came through an experiment with the Clinton administration where taxes were actually raised on most affluent Americans. In 1993, not a single Republican vote. At the time, Senator Phil Graham, Republican Enron, said, we're going to have an economic crash in this country. The wealthy aren't going to invest. Well, we know what happened. We had one of the longest booms we've ever had. And we discovered something there, that in the modern economy, the key integer, the key mover, the dynamic factor is monetary policy, interest rates. And they are sensitive precisely to budget balance. Balance the budget, start to pay off the debt, and interest rates come down to accommodate. And what do you have? You have a boom. The other model, the model of spend and cut taxes, produced, what did it produce? It helped to produce the runaway deficits of the Reagan years, which led to the recession of 1990-91. So we have had, you know, a lot about in economics is just talk, just somebody's theory. We just had an example of what worked.
Michael's calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Flyover country. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, a little rough, but give
okay.
It to us.
Mr. Krugman, since you say you're not holding back any punches, I won't either. I'm very offended at the fact you're trying to tell us laymen out here that President Bush has been president for less than 2 years, but his economical policy has made a major downturn in the market, whereas actually the downturn is coming from the fact that a lot of people, like myself, do not believe or are having a hard time believing in corporate earnings, which, for the past 8 years, before that, Mr. Clinton was a president.
And I tell you, that's two callers in a row who have quoted me saying something I didn't say.
Michael, I'm going to let you go because your phone line is rough. But how about this? Let's go just to the issue of who is responsible. President Bush has suggested in recent days that it's the excesses of the Clinton era that have put us in the pickle we're in now. Paul Krugman, what do you make of that?
Oh, gosh. Look, some of it, there were a lot of excesses, I think, and a lot of them, most of them occurred under Clinton because that was when we had the great boom. To some extent, those excesses are responsible for the problems we've got. To some extent, the problems we've got are the result of not very clear-headed policy. But I don't think that it would be fair to say that Bush caused the downturn either in the economy or in the stock market. All that I've said is that now that it turns out that the world is very different from anything that was contemplated back in the fall of 1999 when Bush said a tax cut is the answer to all our problems, we ought to be thinking about reconsidering policy, and yet not a period, not a comma has been changed in the basic plan. So it's not saying that this is Bush's fault. What I'm complaining about is the absence of a response. And that, by the way, is an unfavorable comparison with the Clinton administration. We did have a world financial crisis in 1997-98, and we had a not perfect but certainly very impressive response by the Clinton administration to that crisis. There is nothing like that going on right now.
And so you're saying it falls to Bush to respond to the current crisis, and he's not doing it. You've written that he's not a real reformer. He just plays one on TV.
Yeah.
You said that the game has been rigged on behalf of insiders, and his administration is full of such insiders. Put some meat on those bones. What do you say?
Well, okay, let's talk first just about substantive policy. It should have been clear as soon as the Enron thing broke. Politics, connections all aside, it should have been clear that this was not likely to be an isolated instance, that once you realized what a company that was for a while the seventh largest capitalization in the economy, once you realized that a company that big, that prominent, could be a fraud, that there must have been something very wrong with the accounting, something very wrong with the incentives, we should have moved to do something about reform immediately. Instead, the administration, and by the way, I did say that. I mean, I called that one right. I said this is the tip of the iceberg. The administration spent 6 full months opposing any substantive changes. It spent 6 full months even opposing any increase in the budget of the Securities and Exchange Commission. It didn't want to do a blessed thing. Only when it became clear that all hell was breaking loose did the administration suddenly decide that George Bush was a champion of honest business. And even then, his initial speech on Wall Street was full of sound and fury, but content free.
What do you trace this to?
Basically, I mean, a couple of things. One is you can ask about their friends in Congress and who their campaign contributions come from. The other thing is this: almost everybody. There are a lot of people in this administration who have some experience with business. The kind of experience they've had is of being the beneficiaries of the kind of system that produced an Enron. They were insiders, and I mean we're seeing that in excruciating detail now as the inquiry into Halliburton at the time when Dick Cheney was getting tens of millions of dollars in stock options.
But do you mean that very literally? I mean, these were not Enron scale or Enron structured companies that they worked in.
They were, you know, Enron was the extreme on the scale. Enron was unique. We hope. I don't think there was anything that big that was entirely a fraud. Even WorldCom had some real earnings in there. What you have, though, is that they were all associated. Well, I mean, first of all, look, the Secretary of the Army was an Enron executive who ran a division that was. Its main product turns out to have been about $500 million of fake profits. So we're talking quite literally about people who were part of that. But no, the point is that Enron-style or WorldCom-style manipulation of earnings so as to keep the stock price high and the value of executive stock options high.
You call it crony capitalism, sort of mutual back-scratching and deal-making.
Yeah, not my term, by the way, but the point is that this was true of Bush's business career. It was true of Cheney's business career. It's the kind of people they feel comfortable with.
But
and
we've
so
got
it's
a
very
real...
hard for them to believe that the Enron event meant the end of that system, which it turns out it does.
And we've got a real crisis now, as the drumbeat of news demonstrates. Can we address it with the administration that we have?
Well, I think at this point, on the issue of corporate reform, they've discovered that there's a parade heading off where they don't want to go, and they're scurrying around to get in front of it. I'm not sure. I'm no kind of congressional maneuvering expert, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Sarbanes bill, which is sort of 50% of what you ought to do, will in fact, more or less intact, become the law of the land, even though a lot of Republicans in the House still want to kill it. So they're doing something there, but it's always going to be half-hearted, and as new problems crop up, everything we know about them suggests that they're going to try to avoid doing anything until absolutely forced to.
Listeners, we're talking tonight with Paul Krugman about fact and fiction and the Bush administration and its handling of the economy. What do you think of President Bush's economic leadership, of the president's economic team? Are we in the grip of crony capitalism, or are these just the fortunes of the free market? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to talk with us, to talk with New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New York Times columnist and Princeton economist Paul Krugman about the Bush administration's leadership on the economy. Are Harkin and Halliburton relevant today? What do they tell us about our economy and our leaders? And does the Bush administration deserve a gadfly with as big a bite as Paul Krugman's? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dana is on the line from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Dana. You're on the air.
Greetings, gentlemen. I don't know how many Pulitzers your guest has, but hopefully this year he'll get what he deserves, which would be a Pulitzer. Phil Graham is one of the reasons we're not going to see anything done during this administration. His wife is on the board of Enron. That aside, notice how well Neil Bush is being kept out of the limelight. after he had his fingers in so many pies during the fiasco of all the savings and loans being deposed. And what was his personal responsibility for, $44 million or $184 million? My question is, if I saw this, now I only have 4 years of college, I dropped out to go to work, and admittedly I failed political science and had to take it over and still got a D in it. If I read three different cities' newspapers a week, if I read Time Magazine and Newsweek and occasionally the New York Times when I can afford it, how come I saw this prior to the election, but generally the electorate did not see it? I was smelling this in the summer of 2000. Why wasn't anyone else except individuals like your guest today?
Well, it's an interesting question. First of all, I mean, it was a close victory, so we acknowledge that. But George Bush won. And Paul Krugman, what does that tell you about the way Americans see and want to see their economics?
I think that part of it is that George Bush ran as someone he has turned out not to be. And I'm not talking about the personal stuff now, but we'll get to that in a second. But the whole many people I know were just not very excited about the election. They said, oh, there's really not much difference between the candidates. You know, Bush will be a bit more conservative, but, you know, the basic continuity will remain. When I said, you know, I'm worried about this program, I think it might actually push us back into deficit, they said, oh, don't be silly. You know, and I think people were lulled into the sense that nothing much was at stake. Bush certainly had an appealing TV presence. A lot of polls have said that, you know, people asked of various politicians, who would you like to spend a night watching sports with? And George Bush is high on the list. And that's a hell of a way to choose your president, but unfortunately, I think people do that. It's also true that the media, the large-scale media, the TV and so on, basically gave him something of a free pass. Almost nothing I've reported in columns in the last month or so has been really news. It was all there. If you'd read Molly Ivan's little book Shrub, if you'd read Joe Connison and Harper's, if you had LexisNexis and went and read back issues of the Houston Chronicle, you would have known pretty much this whole story.
But we didn't. You're right, and we're reading an awful lot more about Harkin Energy than we ever did, or at least we're paying a lot more attention today. What about the personal stuff? Is this fair? President Bush says it's not fair. It's history. It's been dealt with. Let's get on with it. But is it fair to be going back and looking at Harkin, looking at Halliburton? What about the personal stuff?
Well, remember, Halliburton is quite recent history. Halliburton, we're talking about stuff that was happening just a few years ago. The reason, again, let me come back to where I started. Mm-hmm. This administration has, to an unprecedented extent, tried to brush aside substantive discussion of its policies by putting Mr. Bush himself on a pedestal. You're not supposed to ask questions about why the numbers don't add up or why crucial policy decisions are being taken out of the public eye and not getting a public hearing, or who was on that energy task force anyway, because we're supposed to trust in the character of George Bush, the self-made businessman, the plain, truthful, plain-spoken guy who likes to spend his time on the old family ranch in Texas.
And you're not buying it.
And, well, you know, it's demonstrably true. It's not even arguable that portrait has nothing to do with who he really is, and that certainly has to, and that has to be relevant. And there is a little bit, when the Enron story first broke, Mary Madeline, the White House aide and wife of James Carville, I don't know, that's a weird thing, but anyway, trying to belittle it, said, "Oh, this isn't some missing records or a cattle deal," or went through a litany of really trivial stuff about the Clintons, of course, finishing with the blue dress. Mm-hmm. If she thought that those things were more important than Enron, then since, except for the blue dress, Bush's history is full of things that are
much, much larger than any of those. Why shouldn't we be talking about it?
Paul Krugman, a couple of quick questions. First, do we run a risk of choking off the economy with the wave of regulation that's now being brewed in the effort to push back against corporate scandal?
I think not a chance. None of these regulations are the kinds of things that would deter people from investing in or lending to a good company. There's nobody, the one thing that where you might get worried is not actually in the legislation. Some people have said, well, if you force companies to expense stock options,
then our incentives go to shut
down. Venture capital won't be able to work. Actually, that's not in the legislation. I don't even believe that one. So I can't imagine that any of that stuff is really going to be an issue.
So give that a green light. You raised the Japan example briefly earlier. You've written about the threat of a deflationary cycle. What's the threat there?
There's a limit to what Alan Greenspan can do. It's called zero. He can't push the interest rate that's under his control, the Fed funds rate, below zero. It's actually at 1.75 now. It's not that far from zero. There is a situation, used to be considered mostly hypothetical, where an economy gets up against the zero bound, liquidity trap. I can go on and on with economics jargon, but let me just say, if an economy gets depressed so that even a zero interest rate is not enough to get it back on the course of recovery, and if prices start falling because the economy is depressed, then you get into a sort of grinding downward spiral, because nobody wants to borrow, even at a zero interest rate, if they know that by the time they have to repay the loan, a dollar will be worth more or a yen will be worth more than it is today.
So goodbye to robust growth.
Goodbye, yeah. What Japan has demonstrated kind of horrifyingly is that you can have a seemingly highly successful economy can stumble into this situation and lose at this point now. We're talking about 12 years.
Are we at risk of that?
Yeah. I mean, it's not my forecast, but is it beyond the realm of possibility? No, it's not.
Let's get one more call. Rick's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening, gentlemen. See, I'd like to just say I think some of the earlier callers who were putting words in Mr. Krugman's mouth were just frustrated that he didn't give the standard conservative talk show arguments for them to rebut.
What's your question, Rick?
I'd like to say I've always wondered if the Bush team is so sharp, why they hide everything they do. It seems as though they're throwing up more smoke screens than information. And also, I think they're a little afraid that the public's beginning to catch on that their conservative agenda is really more or less social Darwinism.
Rick, our time's running low, but Paul Krugman, what about the level of secrecy? I know you haven't been following this as a columnist over many administrations, but does it strike you as extraordinary?
Oh, yeah. No, this is again, you have to go back to Richard Nixon to find this kind of level of secrecy. I think it's just that they know that the dissonance between the populist front they put on and the insider privileged nature of the people who make the policy and in whose interest the policy is made is very large, and it won't stand the light of day, and so they close the shades.
And I guess last question, we're told that it's consumers and their debt that have kept the economy going to the extent that it has. Is there an alternative to consumer and consumer debt-led growth? What is it?
At this point, what we want is business investment to come back, but that's not going to happen for a while. And I think everything we can do now in economic policy is about building a bridge to the point at which businesses are ready to invest again. And I'm actually very nervous that the consumer part of that bridge is about to collapse.
Jack Beattie, are you taking any consolation in Paul Krugman's view tonight?
No, I'm not. But yes, I am. I mean, it is a bracing and realistic pessimism, and it pierces so much of what passes for talk about economic policy in the media. So I salute him. I think he's a national asset.
There you go, Paul Krugman, national
am I
asset.
Losing value as quickly as the other national asset?
Down they go. Okay. Paul, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks a lot.
Great to have you. Paul Krugman, op-ed columnist with the New York Times and professor of economics at Princeton University. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, we crash land at Roswell, New Mexico. This is On Point.
believe that UFO means that we have a unbelievable financial opportunity here in Roswell, and the fact that we've got thousands of visitors who come to Roswell. And also, you couldn't buy this type of exposure. Everyone worldwide knows about Roswell.
That was Sean Hughes, CEO for the Roswell, New Mexico Chamber of Commerce. Earlier this month, he and his fellow Roswell residents welcomed all life forms to celebrate the tiny desert town's annual UFO festival. Sometime during the first week of July 1947, something crashed near Roswell, and a tourist trap was born. Now in its fifth year, the Roswell UFO Festival attracts thousands of Earthlings for 4 days of all things extraterrestrial. Sean Hughes and a few Roswell residents talk about their festival and their town.
The UFO Festival here in Roswell is kind of a celebration. It's a combination of a lot of people coming together, and we just have fun and celebrate the anniversary of the 1947 Roswell incident. We had in between 10 and 12,000 people who showed up here in Roswell for the four-day festival and experienced all kinds of fun events from concerts to an alien chase. We had a costume contest. And I tell you, it's fun to watch the children who are both in the costume contest as well as the children who are looking at all the various aliens that are parading around on the stage. One of the children that I recall best was dressed entirely in blue, and she was just darling. She was completely blue, and she won the cutest children's costume contest. And the categories include cutest, scariest, funkiest, and most likely to succeed in space.
My name is Frank Gamboa. My wife and I own the Crashdown Diner in Roswell, New Mexico, and I'm also the UFO Festival Parade Chairman. Parade was pretty darn good, if you ask me. It was a nighttime parade, and so we had a good turnout from spectators. The winners were, first place was our Walmart store, who had a float that was basically shaped like a ship, and it was beaming up one of their shopping carts. The second place winner was Sky Disc, which is a local family who had a craft that was shaped more or less like what reports were of the craft that crashed here in 1947. And the third place winner was a group from Florida called VW Enthusiasts, and they had older model Volkswagen vans that they had totally decked out in alien attire, including a little alien in a stroller that they strapped to the top of the van.
My name is Corey Beck, and I'm the publisher of the Roswell Daily Record newspaper in Roswell, New Mexico. You know, I mean, the whole thing is basically based on what happened back in 1947, which by all indications are that something crashed near Roswell, New Mexico. As far as what that is, we've never really been able to get any kind of clear answer. You know, the government says that it was a weather balloon and a lot of other things. I think that, you know, whatever crashed here in 1947, it's just kind of opened up a whole mythology. And that's what I find so really interesting. You know, and there's a lot of people who are into folklore and things like that, who are just the whole mythology of Roswell is just fascinating enough.
You know, it's a significant event that took place that actually helped to put Roswell on the world map of places to be at this time of year. You know, and in the event, something happened. Regardless of what the government says, something happened, because over the years, the people who were there and witnessed it all have not changed their story one bit, you know. So I'd like to think that there is life out there other than us, because it would be a boring place if we're it, because we know how we can be, right? And, you know, the government has got to come clean someday.
I think there's just a natural human curiosity about what really exists out there beyond our planet. I think there's just a natural curiosity to stare up at the stars and think, are we alone in the universe?
Voices from the UFO Festival in Roswell, New Mexico. For more information on the festival, log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.